This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, it is The Bigger Picture and it's Meera Sivasuthi. I have the honour of having peace activist and author Miko Pellard with me. We're trying to get to know him and some of the good work he's done. He's actually the author of a book titled The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Very interesting, and welcome to the show, Miko.
Thank you.
Miko, you grew up in Jerusalem to Jewish parents, and yet you only met your first Palestinian friend in California when you were 39. I mean, what do you remember of your growing up years?
Well, I remember growing up in a country that was called Israel, so Palestinians really don't have any part in it. And growing up in Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city, you know, most of my life was post-1967, so all of Jerusalem, including East Jerusalem, was part of the city. Mm-hmm. But growing up, there was no contact, and there was never any attempts made to bring Israeli children and Palestinian children together. The city is really completely segregated and actually very quite racist. Mm-hmm. So there was never an opportunity, I mean, to meet or to engage with Palestinians in any way at all.
Okay.
And we don't learn Arabic. And of course, the Palestinians speak Arabic. So that was how I grew up. There was no connection at all.
Okay. And at 39, you met your first Palestinian friend.
In the United States.
What was that like?
It was very interesting. It was welcoming and encouraging in one way. Because we have so much in common. We have the same memories, especially the ones who came from Jerusalem. You know, we have the same memories, we know the same, almost the same places. And on the other hand, it was a challenge because they had a story to tell that I never heard of. Mm-hmm. Their history, even though it talks about our combined history, is a completely different story, and that was a story that I was never exposed to. Mm-hmm. So that was a little frightening, and it was challenging to somehow bridge that gap between this very clear history that I thought was true and this other history that they were presenting, mm-hmm. which was very personal because we met it was a very personal setting. It was a dialogue, so it was very personal. It wasn't a debate or a discussion or anything like that. So I couldn't discount them as being, you know, liars or being anti-Semitic or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Because everybody just told their personal story. And bridging that gap between the history that I grew up on, which was also very personal, and the history of the state of Israel and what they were presenting, it took a lot of time for me to figure out a way how to bridge that and how to accept, first of all, that there was legitimacy to a story that was different than mine, which is a really big and difficult step to take. And then eventually examining the two histories and realizing that the history that the Palestinians presented was actually the true version of the events. The history that I was taught was really a myth. And that was a very long and painful process.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Just to go back a little bit. I mean, your grandfather was a Zionist and your father an Israeli military general who turned pro-Palestinian later on. Were you ever a Zionist?
Yes, of course.
Why don't you explain the difference between a Zionist and a Jew?
Well, being Zionist means you accept that Jewish people have a right to have a Jewish state in Palestine. And I come from a family, my grandparents all immigrated to Palestine because they were Zionists. They accepted that premise that Jewish people today, because they are the descendants of the ancient Hebrews who lived there, you know, some 2,000-3,000 years ago, have a right to go back and live there. Mm-hmm. And the word, and they, when they say go back and they use the word return, it's really quite absurd. It's not the same people, really. This was 2,000-3,000 years ago and so on. But this was the premise, and it was based on the fact that there was intolerance toward Jewish people in Europe, and so this was the solution the Zionists presented. Mm-hmm. So my grandparents immigrated based on that. On my mother's side, my grandfather became a Zionist leader. He was he was a spokesman for the Zionist movement in Europe. He was a member of the provisional government, the Zionist government that existed before the state of Israel was established. Later on, he was an ambassador. He signed the Declaration of Independence. So that's a lot of Zionist heritage.
Yes.
This is my mother's father. My father himself, when he was young, he was born there. My parents are first generation, which you would call Israelis, although their birth certificates say Palestine, because that's where they were born, really. I mean, that's what it was called when they were born.
Yep.
So my father was born there. When he was in high school, he joined the Zionist militia, believing that the Jews had a right to fight for this country. at first against the British who governed and then against the Palestinians. And then my father remained in the military when Israel was established and eventually became a general. So this is a lot of Zionist heritage to carry. Mm-hmm. So there's no question that I was very Zionist and I believed in the cause and so forth. But along the way, as I was growing up, there were cracks that were building very gradually and very slowly that eventually allowed me to make this transition.
Okay. And when you found out that, you know, the history that you knew was a myth, I mean, were you not upset that you were not told about this by family members?
I was very upset. Mm. I'm still upset. I think one of the biggest issues is the sense of betrayal. You know, and again, coming from my particular background, where the history is not something you read about in school, the history is part of the family lore. It's part of the family story, and perhaps from a certain perspective, what I was learning may have had its truth, but in the big picture, of course, it was part of a myth. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. But like I said, over the years, as I was growing up, especially when I was working on the book, as I looked back at my journey into Palestine, I could see where those cracks began to form with things that my mother told me and did, and things that my father did after he retired from the military and so on. So it was a gradual process, and there was some, like I said, there were some cracks that were being formed as I was growing up.
Mm-hmm. But your father became pro-Palestine later on. How did that happen?
Well, he was one of the generals during the 1967 war. And, in fact, in the discussions leading up to the war, he was probably the most, the strongest voice for war, to begin that war. And it was talking about a limited war against Egypt, but still, he was a very dominant force pushing for that war. But as soon as the war was over and Israel ended up, it wasn't a limited war against Egypt only, because the Israeli army ended up taking the West Bank and the Golan Heights. So while still in uniform, he stood up and he said, now we must make peace with the Palestinians. We still share this country with these people. If we don't allow them to establish a state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, then we will end up being a binational state. It's not going to be the Jewish democracy which the Zionists wanted. And we will be, we'll have to fight a resistance, and it's going to be a disaster. And then he eventually retired. About a year later, he retired, and he continued the rest of his life promoting that idea that Palestinians have a right to self-determination within the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, mm-hmm. and also that Palestinians who remained in what became Israel and became Israeli citizens have a right to receive equal rights, which they don't have. And sadly, both of these things have not been achieved. My father passed away in 1995. Still, these two things have not been achieved. Their recognition of their right to self-determination has not been accomplished, has been recognized, mm-hmm. and they do not enjoy equal rights within Israel either.
Okay, you must have received a lot of criticisms from Israelis worldwide for the work that you do. How have you handled that?
Well, I haven't actually. I think because the scope of my work is beyond the scope of what Israelis are willing to discuss. And pro-Israelis too, you know, in the U.S. and in the West in general, there's a scope beyond which nobody wants to engage, and that is the discussion of the anti-Zionist discussion, which is, you know, what my the way I speak now. It's decidedly anti-Zionist, and because it's beyond that scope, nobody wants to engage. Mm-hmm. So there is really no conversation with people within Israel. I don't even know if they know I wrote a book.
Okay. Were you ever Zionist? I mean, of course, by default, you possibly were. But when did you let go of some of that?
Well, it was a process. Beliefs? Of course, I was a Zionist. I lived my whole life believing in this cause. But I knew that there were some problems. I knew, for example, because of the work my father did after he retired from the military, that Palestinians had a right to self-determination, that Palestinians within Israel deserved equal rights, but it didn't shatter my belief in Zionism. I believe that Jews have the right to have their own state and should be recognized and so forth. And it wasn't until, you know, several years into my activism and into my work with Palestinians, and again, my journey into Palestine, and even though Palestine and Israel are the same country, Israelis never don't know that there's a Palestine. They don't know that there's a people and a culture and a heritage that are there right next door. Mm-hmm. I mean, really next door. It's a very small country. And as this journey was as I was proceeding in this journey, I realized that there really is no justification for Zionism. There is no justification for a state that's called a Jewish state, which I don't really think Israel is a Jewish state. But that the reality that exists today can't justify it, because half the population are not Jewish, so you can't have a Jewish state in a country mm-hmm. where half the population is not Jewish. So it was a process that took several years.
Okay. When we come back, we'll find out more about Miko Peled. He's actually a peace activist and an author. Karate, sixth degree black belt in karate, is something I'm interested in to find out more about Miko. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Mira Sivasodi. We're getting to know Miko Peled. He's a peace activist and author, an interesting individual who grew up as a Zionist in Palestine, in Israel, and sort of met his first Palestinian friend at the age of 39, changed his views as to, you know, the whole conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, and he's here to tell us his story. I mean, Miko, you remarkably followed in your father's footsteps. I mean, you joined the military and then you denounced your allegiance to Israel. What caused you to change your mind, really? I mean, can you speak about the smother, if you're comfortable talking about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, when you said Palestine and not Israel, it's fine, because it is the same country.
It is. But in our minds, it isn't, right? We're always talking about Palestinians and Israelis.
And the whole issue of Zionism, I think it's important to point out, initially most Jews, and to this day, most Jews are not Zionists. They've never been to Israel. They probably will never go. There's always been a strong Jewish contingent that opposed the state of Israel and opposed the creation of the state of Israel. And many Jews who are critical of the state of Israel today, they don't get as much voice. Their voice is not as heard as much as the pro-Israeli Jewish communities. But I see them in America and in Canada and in the West a lot, and they're very active. So there is a big difference between what it means to be Jewish in general mm-hmm. and then to be a Zionist. And the Zionists were always a smaller group, although they were very militant and very, very vocal. So I grew up with this background. In 1997, in September of 1997, my sister lost her little girl, her daughter, in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. And I was living in the United States already at the time. And of course, when something like that happens, she was 13 years old, you don't really know what to think or say. It's such a terrible thing. And this is always big news in Israel when there was a suicide attack. And of course, in the late 90s, there were many. It was a very difficult time. But it was bigger news this time because she was the granddaughter of a very well-known Israeli general.
Yep.
He had died 2 years before that. And also he was a general that turned around and became a voice for Palestinian rights. So this was massive news in Israel. And by the time I arrived, which was less than 24 hours after this happened, my sister's apartment was filled with mourners, but also filled with reporters from Europe, from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And when my sister came out finally to see everybody, the questions are always the same. The questions are, well, what about retaliation and who's responsible and what should we do? And the first words that came out of her mouth were, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. Retaliation is insane. It's stupid. To kill somebody as in response for the death of somebody, you know, especially of a child. And then she quoted a famous Jewish poet who said, there is no vengeance that's appropriate for the death of a child anyway. What do? You kill millions, thousands? I mean, there is no vengeance that's appropriate. And vengeance is really not appropriate. And she said, in terms of who's responsible, she said, these two young Palestinians who blew themselves up were brought to such a level of despair that not only did they kill others, but they took their own lives, mm-hmm. which is a terrible thing to do. She said, but it's the brutal oppression and the brutal occupation that we, the Israelis, have placed upon the Palestinians that have brought them to do this horrific act, to take this horrific measure. And she said, when you take away people's land and then you destroy their homes and then you incarcerate their fathers, because Israel has thousands of political prisoners who are Palestinians. And then she said, and when we shoot their brothers and sisters in their schools and we do all these horrific things, this is what happens. What do we expect? And both she and her husband said, we hold the Israeli government directly responsible for our daughter's death. So now everything, this became even bigger news, because here's this bereaved mother turning everything upside down. Mm-hmm. Because in the West, we know the Palestinians are bad, the Israelis are good.
Yep.
The Palestinians are terrorists, the Israelis want peace. and the Israelis are victims. Now she's told a different story here. And ever since then, both she and her husband and her other boys have become active, very, very active, vocal about this issue. And I went back to the United States and I felt like I had to do something. You know, when you see the small coffin of a 13-year-old being put in the ground, it's not something you just shake off the next day. And it took some time before I found what I was looking for, and it was this group of American Jews and Israelis meeting with Palestinians in the United States. It was a dialogue group. And again, this was my first time meeting with Palestinians on kind of a very casual and personal basis, but also it was the very first time that I, as an Israeli, was with Palestinians, and we were completely equal. So there were no restrictions on them. The laws that governed me governed them. So in terms of the law, we were completely equal. That doesn't exist over there within Israel or the West Bank or Gaza, of course. There were no restrictions. They didn't need permits. There were no curfews. I mean, there were no checkpoints. And that has never happened. I've never met Palestinians like that before.
Right. So where did you start? I mean, what did you start doing to bring about more peace in both countries?
Well,
or in both states?
Well, it's one country and it is one state. That's the whole thing. It's one country and it's one state, but it's...
How would you describe it then? Between what?
It's between the two people.
Okay.
Yeah, Israelis and Palestinians. And I say Israelis and Palestinians because Jewish people have no issue with Palestinians. It's Israelis who are there. The Israelis are this creation that was created over the last 75, 80 years of you know, as a result of Jewish immigration to Palestine. But they're there now. So these are the two nations. But it's one country. It's one country with exclusive rights for Jewish people, even though half the population are not Jewish. Mm-hmm. They're Palestinian Muslims.
Okay.
So first of all, meeting and listening to the stories was a big step. Then I began traveling into the West Bank and traveling into Palestinian communities all over the country, and studying the language and the culture and reading their literature and understanding their point of view and realizing that their point of view is actually the right point of view. And that's what I do today. I speak, I write, I publish the book, I have articles, I have a blog, and I protest when I'm there with Palestinians. I was in Gaza recently, which was interesting because as an Israeli, I'm not permitted by Israeli law to go to Gaza. The Egyptians wouldn't allow me to enter for some reason. I tried several times. Mm-hmm. I think on this issue, they're very close to the Israelis. So I ended up going in through a tunnel.
Okay.
And which was a very interesting experience in itself.
You want to tell me about it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, to go from Jerusalem to Gaza is a very easy drive. It's an hour and 20 minutes. It's really very easy to go. But because I can't go that way, I ended up flying down to Eilat, which is on the coast of the Red Sea, crossing into the Sinai, which is Egypt, traveling there. The Egyptians wouldn't let us go directly to in the direction of Gaza, so we had to go another direction. And about 14 hours later, I was exactly in Rafah, which is the place where the tunnels begin, and ready to go a 5-minute walk into Gaza under mm-hmm. the ground.
Okay.
And then I found myself exactly 1 hour and 20 minutes away from the place where the trip began 14 hours earlier.
Oh, dear.
Which is an absurd situation. But
it
I
is,
mean,
it is.
For me, it was an inconvenience. But for Palestinians, 1.6 million Palestinians who live in Gaza under siege, it's a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. It's inexplicable and inexcusable that 1.6 million people who live in a country where half an hour from where they live, there is no issue of hunger, there is no issue of unemployment. This is a very highly educated population, and they have to rely on tunnels. They're estimated to be about 1,500 tunnels mm-hmm. on this very narrow stretch of land of maybe 7 kilometers. They have to rely on these tunnels for food, for oil, for money, for a little bit of, you know, to be able to leave the strip. It's absolutely unheard of. People talk about the Palestinian catastrophe. The Nakba that took place in 1948, I would argue it began in 1948 and still goes on today with children that can't get proper medical care and have to suffer hunger or what they call food insecurity, which is perhaps, you know, most of the time hunger, not always hunger. When they're half an hour drive from medical centers and food sources and everything mm-hmm. only because they're Palestinian. This is a catastrophe, and this is something that cannot be allowed to continue. And the fact that it is allowed to continue today under our watch, 65 years after this catastrophe began, is inexcusable and unjustifiable.
And when did you actually start all this activism work?
Would you say upon the death of your niece, that was the push? Yes, mm-hmm. That's pretty much.
And that was
it
in
1997.
So it's been about 16 years now.
Yeah.
What have been some of your challenges in trying to bring these two people together?
Well, the biggest challenge is that Israelis don't want to hear. Israelis don't want to know, and they don't want to hear. Israelis, because the country is so segregated, and because Israelis are educated in a way that's really quite racist, you know, they see that they believe they have exclusive rights, really, on the entire country, which is why Israel governs the whole country, and there's never been a separation of the country. There's never been a partition, a successful partition for two states, as many people wanted it to thought there should have been. But I think that's the biggest challenge, and I think in many ways it's similar to other racist countries, like perhaps South Africa, where you had one group controlling or dominating the land and the resources and didn't want to engage with the other group. And that's probably the biggest challenge, but I think at the same time, the fact that you have 6.5 million Israelis and 6 million Palestinians living in one country, governed by the same government, albeit under different laws, mm-hmm. Makes it so it is one state with exclusive rights to only one part of the population, which cannot be sustained. Besides being immoral, unjust, and wrong, it's also unsustainable because it's a small country and there are areas where the two sides have to engage, right. even with the segregation. But I would say that's the toughest challenge, and the fact, of course, that the West is behind Israel by and large, at least Western governments are, make it slightly a bigger challenge because there's a lot of power there. But things are changing. I mean, I see even in America, which is probably the most pro-Israeli country in the world, and in Canada, there are a lot of cracks that are beginning to form in that support for Israel. So that's where I get my optimism. Mm-hmm.
Do you find, or are there like-minded people like yourself, Israelis, who are interested to do similar work that you are, or who understand and, you know, are on the same page?
There are. I mean, there are several. I mean,
it's not enough, though.
It's not enough. I mean, because in numbers, it's very small. I mean, you have people like Ilan Pape, who's a well-known historian, who's an Israeli. You have people like my sister, who is an educator. She still lives there. She just wrote a book about the Israeli education system, exposing that it's a very racist education system, and so forth. And there are small Israeli groups. There are Israelis who refuse to serve in the military, several thousands of them. Refuse on as conscientious objectors, which is the only, it's the only thing that is not excusable in Israel. So they actually have to go to jail. Whereas if they said they have, you know, they have a sore back or they something like that, they would probably be excused from the military. But they won't lie and they say, so there are forces within Israel, but it's very, very, very small. And I think, you know, no group that has privileges has ever been willing to give up their privileges, you know, willingly. Mm-hmm. So that's where there's a struggle. That's where there was an anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. Even among the white South Africans, there were voices, you know, that talked about equality. That by and large, the reality was that whites did not want apartheid to end. And by and large, Israelis don't want to see change. They're afraid and they like to have the exclusive rights to the land.
Okay. You know, you're the author of a couple of books, one of which you wrote about your father. It's titled The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Israeli in Palestine.
Yes.
Have your books been banned by any chance in Israel?
No.
Okay. No. So it is allowed in the market.
It's allowed, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I don't think it's selling, it's a bestseller or anything yet, but it's there.
But
yes.
It's there.
Yes.
All right. Okay, yes. That's good. Let's talk about karate. I mean, just to digress a little, I mean, you've achieved a 6th degree black belt in karate. I mean, what sparked that interest?
Well, when I was in high school, I was, like many people, just, you know, very excited, very enthralled by martial arts. And I began practicing when I was in high school. And then later on in life, I decided to make it a career. I studied in England, and I lived in Japan for a few years, and I traveled there many, many, many times, to Japan and Okinawa. And I was just, I love the martial arts. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's a wonderful philosophy. It's the true martial arts, of course, philosophy is a very nonviolent, almost pacifist philosophy, because the idea is that you train yourself, but then you never use it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if
you use it, you've defiled it. If you use, like if you use the sword, you've defiled it. Yeah. You have to throw it away, break it. Physically, it's challenging. It's interesting. Spiritually, it's challenging and it's interesting. I know Malaysia has got some very interesting martial arts as well, and I hope to visit some martial arts schools while I'm here.
But does karate sort of relate to your activism work in any way?
I think it does, yes. I think the philosophy of not using violence is very, very important to me personally, although the training and challenge is very interesting. And facing odds that seem impenetrable, but then realizing that if you use your mind and you use patience, then there's no obstacle that you can't overcome, mm-hmm. is a big part of this. I mean, when we look at Israel, people become very very pessimistic. They say, how can you possibly make a difference in this? Israel is so strong, and Israel has got the support of America. And I think, well, there's a way to overcome this challenge as well. And I think that training has helped me to do that.
Mm-hmm. And you use karate to sort of help Palestinian refugee children?
Well, I wouldn't say help, but I've got friends, Palestinian friends who have martial arts schools, and so I've visited them and trained with them and practiced and taught with them. And I was a couple of times I was in a refugee camp near Bethlehem, Dehesha particularly. And I stayed there at the camp, on the camp for a while, and taught karate to children who were just children in the camp, because they have no after-school activities or anything like that, of course, you know, with the restrictions that they live under. And it was a wonderful experience. I think I gained more than I gave by working with these wonderful kids and learning about them and seeing their perspective. And, of course, karate is a great medium. It's fun. It's interesting. Kids love it. So it's a great opportunity to work with kids that way.
Did it empower them in any way?
Well, I hope it did. I mean, it's hard to say, but I certainly hope that it did. Palestinian children, even with all the oppression and everything, I don't get the impression that they're kids who need empowerment. They're very strong. I think they come from wonderful families, very strong communities. Palestinians are not weak in any way. They're not the kind of community that need help from Israelis or people like me or anybody. They're very well empowered, and they're very strong, and they're very resilient. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it was a joy working with those kids just because they're wonderful kids, you know, and they are strong, and they do have a different perspective. They've seen things by the age of 12 that no kids should see. They've seen their houses destroyed. They've seen their parents incarcerated, dragged to jail. They've seen loved ones killed. My impression is, at least, that it has not broken their spirit. It's made them strong. Probably because Palestinian communities and Palestinian families are so strong and wholesome. And again, I don't think it was me helping them. I think I was just there to be there because I enjoyed it and we enjoyed our company.
Mm-hmm. What was your journey like writing that book about, was it about your father and yourself, the general son's journey of an Israeli in Palestine? What was that process like? I mean, memories,
it's
stories,
a wonderful
and
process.
Facts. I mean, did it take you a long time?
It did. I mean, it took probably 4 years to write and edit and so on. But I think the book, of course, began before I even thought of writing a book, because I was forming my opinions and I was going back and re-examining stories that I've learned. This allowed me to go and do it more specifically. You know, I sat with my mother for many, many hours listening to her experiences. She has a big stake in this. Probably the first story I heard, the first crack that was formed in this very pro-Zionist picture was something I heard from her as a child when she was young. It was 1948, and the homes of Palestinians were evacuated were given to Israeli families. This was in Jerusalem, and she refused to take a home. She said, "How could I possibly take the home of another family, of another mother?" And that was my first, and I remember the story being troubling to me because I didn't think that we didn't kick people out. You know, we're the good guys. We didn't do these things. Mm-hmm. And here she was telling me the story about people who were forced out, and she was given a house, and many people that I do know took these homes. And she at 22 and already a mother said, "No, I'm not taking the home of another family. It's wrong." So I spoke to her and learned a lot about that. I went to the Israeli Army Archives to learn about my father's career. Because it was very interesting. It was interesting also that many Palestinians had stories about my father that I'd never heard before. And that's all of that is in the book. You know, it's a perspective that I'd never heard and I never would have heard unless I was writing the book and unless I was able to, you know, take that journey into Palestine and meet these people.
Mm-hmm. Have many people have you received feedback about the book from people who have indeed read it?
Yes, I receive a lot of feedback, mm-hmm. and thankfully most of it is very positive.
Okay.
I think Israelis might think my views are skewed or that my history is skewed, but that's neither here nor there. By and large, the feedback that I get is very positive.
Okay. Where do you see your activism work going forward? I mean, in my mind, it's a huge challenge. What keeps you going? And what have you got planned for the future?
Well, I'm hopelessly optimistic. I think
you've got to be, I think.
Yeah, I think you've got to be. Otherwise, why would you get up in the morning and do this?
Yep.
I think the direction that activism, my activism, and I think everybody who believes in this cause, in the pro-Palestinian cause, has to be decidedly to talk about the end of Zionism and the transformation from the Zionist state to a democracy in Palestine, so that Palestine is free and democratic for everyone, not only for the exclusive, not only with exclusive rights for Jewish people. I think it's inevitable, besides being morally the right thing, I think it's inevitable because you have this population is split basically in half. And that's probably the most important thing is to galvanize and to bring the forces, the pro-Palestinian forces together to talk about this, that this has to be the process, the end of this state that calls itself Jewish, which I don't think it is, into a real democracy where Israelis and Palestinians live as equals, as they should, you know, and enjoy their country and so on and so forth, as equals with equal rights and equal responsibilities and so on. I think that has to be the case. Many activists still talk about this idea of two states, of partition, and that's neither realistic, practical, nor doable, and we've seen that over the last 75 years. There's no possibility for a partition to take place. The only solution that exists is a solution which I call beyond Zionism. It's very similar to South Africa, where you had to get rid of apartheid and the racist system in order for a democracy to take place, and this is the same thing. You have to get rid of this entity, the Zionist state, in order for democracy and peace to take place, because that is the obstacle. You know, the idea that one people have exclusive rights or have more rights than another people, even though they share the land, is absurd. And so that is the challenge. That is where it needs to go, and that's what I talk about. I talk about this, how there is hope and there is a possibility for peace and reconciliation between Israelis and Palestinians, but it has to be done. We have to be able to see beyond the state of Israel, beyond Zionism. And some people are afraid to talk about this, particularly, you know, people who are, you know, Muslims are afraid to talk about this because they get accused of being anti-Semitic and they get accused of wanting to kill everybody, which is, of course, nonsense. Nobody's talking about killing. Nobody's talking about genocide. We're talking about including everybody in a democratic process. We're talking about including everybody in a country where they already live together, but to live as equal, creating the platform where politically they have equal rights and they can live as equals. And I think Israelis and Palestinians will get along very well together. They're very similar societies. You know, most Israelis are actually the descendants of Jewish people who came from Arab countries. They call them Sephardic Jews for some reason, as though they came from Spain. But they didn't. They came from Arab countries. Yeah. Just Israelis don't like to say Arab Jews, but this is who they are.
Right.
And many of them still speak Arabic. Their parents and grandparents certainly speak Arabic still. And so this is one part of the similarity. I mean, education levels are high, are the same. You know, there's a large middle class on both sides. So there are a lot of possibilities for the two sides to get along just fine. But the missing ingredient is the equality. So you can have, you know, Israeli hospitals have Palestinian doctors, wonderful doctors. You know, I always say my mother had surgery recently. She's 86. Her surgeon was Palestinian. But that same Palestinian does not enjoy equal rights, the same rights as an Israeli doctor, and that's absurd.
Well, what would you like to leave Malaysians with in relation to this mayhem of violence that's going on between these two people?
Well, I think, you know, when I got the invitation to come to Malaysia, I began studying a little bit about Malaysia. And one of the things that comes up, interestingly enough, when you look up Malaysia, is that it doesn't never recognize the state of Israel. And yet, you know...
It's stamped in our passport.
Yes, and yet, you know, the sky hasn't fallen, the sun shines in the morning. I mean, you know, Malaysians seem to be doing fine with that, whereas there's this mania around the world that everybody has to recognize Israel and all the time. I think it's a positive stance. I think it's an important stance to take, and I think it's important to realize that there is no reason to recognize or to accept the state of Israel. We need to look beyond Israel into a real democracy. And perhaps join hands with other forces around the world, many Jewish people, whether people are Jewish or not, that are not Zionist, and keep working towards this cause, which I think is a noble cause.
Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Getting to know Miku Peled, a peace activist and author on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.